Welcome to How to Best Prepare, Study, and Perform Well on Tests and Exams. My name is Sara Demmerman, also known as Help Me Sara, and today I'm in conversation with my guest, Janice Lastman. Janice is an education consultant and case manager and author of two books, along with numerous print articles, guides, and curriculum packages. She founded the Tutor Group in 1979, after winding down a busy personal tutoring practice. In addition, Janice's law degree assists her involvement with education law matters and children's parents' rights and responsibilities. Welcome, Janice.
Hello, Sarah.
So today we're going to be talking about, as you know, tests and exams. And maybe we could begin by defining the difference. What's the difference between a test and an exam?
Word quiz there too,
sure.
Because quizzes are a type of test that comes up. So I'll start with a quiz.
Okay.
Quiz, which is sometimes called a pop-up quiz, usually is quick. It doesn't require a lot of notice. In fact, sometimes teachers just give out quizzes that are, you know, with no notice at all, but it has a fairly limited scope. So just a checkup to see how the students are doing, what they've retained material, and with usually minimal preparation required
right.
for a quiz. Tests are a little more in-depth, and in fact, this is where people get confused, the test and the exam might even be the same length. So with older students, you might write a test that is 45 minutes to an hour, even longer, and your exam may be a similar length. But the difference is that the test takes one or two topics or one chapter, let's say in a science book or geography text, and goes into it in depth. Whereas the exam, if you think about the word to examine, looks at a broad scope of many chapters and many topics, and may emphasize one area or another, but you are responsible for a lot of information when you're examining a surface, examining a topic. A test are responsible for specific in-depth information, and a quiz is just a quick surface check on what you might have remembered recently.
So what I'm hearing is, in terms of preparation, I would think that, you know, you can't really prepare for a quiz, as you said, most of the time. It's often pop-up. And for a test, you're focusing on more of a specific area, and an exam, you may need to prepare and study for longer or harder because it's a broader scope of all the material that you've covered.
That's right. And in fact, students who are on top of their work and who do regular review, not everybody does, but if they regularly review their topics and their question sets, their material, often don't have to study a lot for tests because it's current material. You know, you're doing chapter four right now, you're reading, you're keeping on top of it, but many students aren't quite that detailed, and so if you're behind, or if you've missed content, or if you have learning challenges, you are putting time into studying for that test. There's nobody that I know who should not have to study for an exam. When it's an exam, because of the nature and the breadth and the depth of the material, and it can sometimes, if you're in a full year school, it might be 9 or 10 months since you looked at that material last.
Right.
And it could be coming up again. That's a long time to remember. So exams take a lot more preparation. But the amount of time for a test really does vary with the student's readiness with that content material.
So you mentioned the word time, and wanted to ask you a little bit about that and other things in regards to study habits. So, for example, how much time or how often should a student actually spend studying, you know, as opposed to doing homework or readings, for example? And also, can you comment on how this shifts with age and grade? So time, how often, you know, and other good study habits or other study habits that you would consider to be good in regards to successful outcome?
Okay, well, let's take it one step at a time. If we look at the value, how much these evaluations are worth, that can sometimes give us a neat little formula.
Right.
It gives, again, an approximation of the time a student should be putting in to studying. So we're pop-up quiz. We said sometimes you can't even study. But if they're worth anything, they're worth 1 to 5%
right.
of, let's say, a term grade.
Right.
And that means that really, if you're studying, you probably only put in about 5 minutes, okay, 1 to 5 minutes, and with a day or two, because you're not going to get a lot of notice. Okay, but a test is usually worth about 20% of whatever your composite grade is in that area. And that means if you take that formula of 20, you should be doing 20-minute intervals, however many days' notice you've had on that test. So if the teacher told you about that test a week ago or 2 weeks ago, then you should be doing 20 minutes a day for that week or two.
Okay, it's a
now,
great...
Now, if you miss a few, you may have to add some time on.
Right.
But it's better to split that up. In other words, if you skip 3 days, you've forgotten about the test, and now it's Friday, and, you know, you're behind already by 3 days, rather than front-loading it, you want to distribute that extra time into the rest of your study schedule. Okay? And the exam is worth usually about 30%, sometimes as much as 40% of a final mark, but we usually take about that 30-minute intervals for the number of weeks' notice you have. Most people are told, again, we're not talking about the agenda that's distributed or the schedule distributed at the beginning of the year. But when the teacher starts talking about the exam, starts handing out material related to the exam, you should be studying in 30-minute intervals from that time forward.
And that's regardless of what grade you're in?
Well, little ones don't usually have exams.
Right.
Okay, so exams, depending on the school and the school system, can start as early as 4th grade and may not start till 9th grade.
But even tests, for example.
But yes, when something is called an exam, meaning that it covers a lot of material, that's the amount of time that you should be spending. However, what you do with that time is going to vary greatly with your grade.
So even in university, would you say the same formula applies?
Post-secondary is a very different situation, and most good university students will tell you they start studying for exams almost from the day the course begins, but the pattern is harder to give a formula for because it's very much dependent on the course. When university or college students though start studying, what they do, and we've heard this from kids before, you know, they say, is this on the exam? Or
right.
The professor will teach something and say, this is interesting, but it's not on the exam. They do that because they actually expect you to start thinking about and preparing for the exams early on. It's not the kind of thing in post-secondary that you could just do during, you know, reading week, which usually happens about halfway through your term.
Right.
Most students have a week off where they're supposed to study, but you know, many of them will have a little holiday
of
while
course.
They do some studying.
Right.
But it's a little harder. It's a little overly simplistic to have a formula for post-secondary. But really, if you just think about the value of the test or the exam, and multiply that by the number of days or weeks' notice that you have, that's a good amount of time that you should spend preparing.
Okay. Were you going to comment on anything else? You said let's take it one step at a time.
Right. Well, we wanted to talk about the difference in what people do with that time.
Right.
So, you know, little ones, again, grade preschool, grade, you know, JK, SKs, as far as I'm concerned, don't have tests, or the tests they have are not things that they study for.
Right.
But starting in 1st grade, there are often math, spelling tests, occasionally vocabulary or reading tests. And those are the kinds of things that you do want to be preparing for as part of your homework, but you're little, and you might be doing games with that. So all the same card games that you can play with a grade 1, 2, 3 student, like Go Fish or War or Dominoes or any of those, can be played with reading words or math facts. We use dice a great deal with young children. So we roll the dice. And by the way, sir, dice don't just come in 6 sides. I have dice that are up to 20 sides.
Really?
So go to those wonderful game stores where they have, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and all kinds of other games. They sell these wonderful dice that have all kinds of colors and beautiful numbers on them. And children love dice games. So you may have a code where, you know, if you roll this number, it's this kind of question, or we practice. this, just integrate the dice, whether it doesn't have to relate to math. It just may be a series of steps or things to do. So, and that's really motivating.
We're learning through play.
And it's also the idea that you can roll or they can roll.
Right.
But there's a chance, but yet a control element.
Right.
When you're little, avoiding developing test anxiety, making preparing for a test kind of fun training,
yeah,
opposed to anxiety, is really important.
Right.
Because by the time they get into that third to fifth grade, and certainly by the time they get into middle school, sixth to eighth grade, there's often a lot of anxiety around tests because children aren't preparing well. They don't, either they don't have an idea of what's going to be covered, or they don't know their material.
Right.
And I say these days we see more and more schools being very clear about what's going to be tested, almost to the point of giving really detailed sample tests first, as those have pros and cons. But children struggle because if they don't know the content, it's not helpful. They don't understand their content.
Yes.
It's not helpful to know just what's going to be on the test. You need to understand your content.
Well, I guess that's the same as like rote studying, just learning it off by heart, as opposed to understanding what you're studying, correct?
Right. Well, that also gets into, to a certain extent, some of what happens in high school, because we, at the tutor group, we have a strong, what we call anti-cramming policy.
Right.
We do not, if you called us and you were a student or a parent and said, oh, there's a calculus exam coming up in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, no matter how many hours you'd want my tutor for, I would not send you a tutor, because short-term cramming, it reinforces exactly what we hope not to reinforce.
Right.
It can be effective, you know. It could work for the short term. Anybody who has high motivation and a reasonable amount of intelligence and support can learn anything short term. But just like you and I, when we, you know, we cram something that is not important to us or that we've tried to fit in, we might wake up the next day, we have no recall.
Right. And it's also reinforcing the student leaving it perhaps till the last minute.
And reinforcing that someone else will rescue them when that happens.
Right.
It's both. So it stops the student from learning the lessons that in early high school, those trial and error lessons you want a ninth or a tenth grader to learn.
Right. You want them not to be... You want
it also reinforces exactly the wrong thing.
You want them to not be maybe as successful because they've left to the last minute so that they can learn for next time.
Yeah. And in fact, most schools and most school boards in North America will have a policy that if a child repeats or asks to take a test over, their grade will either be averaged or they'll take the higher grade.
Right.
Can't do this indefinitely, but the idea is that teachers really do want students to show what they know on tests.
Are those tests usually different tests or the same test?
They should be different.
Yeah, because otherwise you're just...
It should be the same structure.
Yeah, yeah.
The same patterns, same number of questions, but different content.
Right,
themselves.
Right.
And yeah, most teachers have access to that material, whether it's from their colleagues or it's the test they gave last year. You
right.
know, they should vary their tests each year. So we're not talking about teachers doing extra work.
Right.
But it's important. If a child gets an F on a test, you know, if they fail, they get 20%, whatever. That really, what they failed is they failed to learn.
Right.
That's the point that we want them to accomplish, is to have learned both from the experience and then to have learned the content. Because especially in core courses, math, English, science, some languages, they build on the building bricks of the previous units, the previous grades.
Right.
If you don't have that core content, you're not going to be able to move forward, even if you are more focused, more motivated, whatever. You have to go back and catch up. So we really prefer the student to have a chance to redo some of the tests, especially ones where they've made a bad choice or have chosen not to prepare or have just forgotten. Because we don't want them to fail to learn. We want them to learn the content.
But I guess also, as you were saying, it couldn't be an indefinite thing. You wouldn't want a student to think that every single test he wrote, he could do again, because then again, you're reinforcing
that
he can always get a second chance, which is not true to life.
And that's why some schools schools and many school boards will have what's called a cross-out policy. They will allow teachers and students to take out the lowest mark of the, let's say they have 15 or 20 grades over the year.
Right.
The lowest mark gets dropped.
Right.
But not half the lowest marks.
Right, exactly.
So again, it's a push-pull balance. Sometimes the school will say, well, if you want to redo the math test, you have to show me what, or explain to me what you've done to study for it this time. Because if I'm going to go to the bother to provide you with another test, and I will, you need to show me that you've gone to the bother to prepare for it.
Exactly.
And I think that's fair game.
I think so too. So let's break this into preparing for the studying itself, and then, you know, the actual day of the test or exam, and then what happens afterwards.
Sure.
So in terms of preparing, I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking that really a lot of preparation is a really key point to doing well, right? Or being able to study well. So like I'm thinking things like organization, highlighting, what would you like to talk about in terms of preparing to write a test or exam or take a test or exam?
The first task is making sure that the content is understood. Because if the child doesn't understand the content before they study, someone needs to give them extra help. Many teachers will stay after school or come early and provide, you know, extra support for students. There are peer tutors. There are kids who get their volunteer hours by helping other kids.
And if I can also add, I would imagine you would say too that make sure that the content is complete, right? Because if you as a parent see that your child has, you know, fill in the blank notes in their binder, but many of those lines are still blank.
Are not filled in, yeah.
Right. Then you would obviously be concerned about that. Or
if your child has almost nothing.
Right.
In their binder, which can also happen, either because it never came home, it's sitting in the locker, or because they did badly on something and they hid it. Here's where technology can really help. More and more schools not only have websites, homework websites, but they post handout notes,
right,
tests online.
So parents can...
the blank ones, right?
Right.
So if a child lost their handouts or misplaced them, or if a test is just written all over, you know, because it's hard to study sometimes from something that has too much writing on it, we just print new ones or look at new ones. So that can actually be, I would encourage all parents to know their child's login for the school and the homework website. And that actually goes up to grade 12. That doesn't mean you do it for them. It means that you just can keep track in terms of planning so that you're not imposing, with older kids, you're not imposing arrangements at a time where they should be doing their studying. It'll be up to them to do it at that point. But keeping track of what's coming and knowing how things are posted and accessible reduces a lot of the conflict and a lot of the tension around tests or exams.
So I would imagine that especially in the earlier grades, it would be important for a parent to sit with their child and say, show me what you're studying for, as well as you said, you know, going online and making sure that the child is up to date, but show me what you're studying for and making sure that their notes are organized in a logical way. And then not doing it for them, but asking them, you know, working with them in terms of helping them organize.
Everybody needs a study partner, even older ones. The difference is as you get older, hopefully, you get better at using, whether it's technology for your study partner, a friend who's actually a good study partner, not just a good friend, but little ones, you know, really studying with your child is so helpful because it gives them a chance, you know, to quiz you, to go over things. It's a really helpful.
And you get to relearn history and geography all over again, too.
Yes, you do get to see that the curriculum has changed.
Yeah.
And sometimes to say to your child, wow, I never knew that.
Yeah.
I'm going to pause there and say, it's really important not to pass your own anxieties about a subject onto the child.
Right.
This is not the time to say, oh, I was always terrible at math.
Yeah.
And I've had parents say, oh, well, you know, you come from a family with a long tradition of, you know, people who could never spell.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that is the case, and maybe you'd say that with an older child. But to a younger child, that's not helpful.
Yes, exactly.
But you could say, wow, that's a tough word. it's great that you've learned how to spell that.
Right.
Okay, as opposed to making them feel as if either they can't or they shouldn't have to do it. The other piece, though, with the little ones that I really encourage is to keep, when they are using textbooks, because most textbooks are not online or workbooks are not online for little ones. That is more and more the case for older ones. Please go out and purchase a second set of textbooks for little ones. It's really inexpensive, especially online. Many of these books can literally be bought for $1, $2, $3. There's a wonderful site, and it's not a commercial site, so I'm going to give it a plug, called Abe Books, A-B-E, books.com, and they specialize in textbooks of all sorts. Okay, they may be written, and they may be a little bit ripped, but if you can keep a second set of books at home, A, your child doesn't have to lug them back and forth in the massive backpack,
yeah,
and B, they're there, and so you can always refer to them.
And would you recommend highlighting in a textbook?
Most children do well with highlighting if they know how to highlight. Meaning
right.
that, you know, if the entire page is covered in highlighter,
yeah,
something is wrong. We actually use sticky notes more with little ones than we do highlighting. Highlighting actually requires a fair bit of fine motor control and also self-discipline, you know, knowing when to start and when to stop.
Right.
Sticky notes, for instance, if you're reading a novel together, and these aren't chapter books, they're child with grade 3, 4, or 5, a sticky note helps you to summarize what's happened at the end of every chapter. You put it right in the book, it doesn't damage it, and you've got the summary. Whether the child has dictated it to you and you've written it down, or the child writes it themselves. You shouldn't write the summary because you're not taking the test.
When you say sticky note, I'm visualizing a tiny little sticky note.
They come in all sizes, sir. They are as big as the, if you think about a typical sheet of loose leaf paper, the half size
yes.
of those lined are probably the ones we would use to summarize a chapter.
Right.
Then we do use the little ones because we use them for instance, exciting events.
Right.
In a mystery solved, we'll flag almost the way you would tag photos on social media.
Right.
Even little ones kind of get that. They understand hashtags.
Right.
They understand themes. And so we ask them to think about, well, if you were hashtagging that, if you were choosing the exciting or the momentous or spots, where would that be?
Right.
You use the smaller notes to tag those spots in the book. So, you know, that's another way to study. But the third way that is really good, again, for that grade 3 to 6, even up to grade 8 student, is not, again, just the highlighting, but actually using the table of contents. Most students have no idea what a table of contents is, not the index at the back, but the actual table of contents that lists the chapters and the subchapters at the front.
Right.
Okay? Because it gives a hierarchy. It gives a structure. So your child is studying characteristics of life, and the first chapter is metabolism. What's metabolism? And then it's going to be the metabolism of a human compared to the metabolism of a frog and perhaps a dog. Okay, so
right.
those are three subtopics.
Right.
Textbooks also, for the most part, even online ones, are designed with headings and subheadings in every chapter. So if a child has trouble with highlighting, we usually get them to start by highlighting the headings and the subheadings. And what we do with those is we have them turn them into WH questions, like who, what, where, when, why. So if the heading says meiosis versus mitosis, and you're studying cell theory, the question may be, what is meiosis?
Right.
What is mitosis? How are they different?
Right.
Right. So you see, you don't have to highlight the entire content, but at least you've set the context.
Right.
What they should be able to answer when they read the material. And when you get to actually writing the tests, one of the biggest challenges children have is answering the question asked. They'll often provide an answer, but not what the question asked is. So having them ask the questions themselves first helps a lot with that.
And I guess as part of our being study guides, I always found when my kids were younger, either just quizzing them out loud, or actually writing up some mock tests for them was very helpful.
So writing up mock tests is a great way to do it. Some kids actually are very good at writing their own mock tests.
Yes.
In which case, I encourage them to exchange their mock test with another friend.
That's a good idea.
And they love doing that for them, especially now you can scan things, you can set it up. Like, it's really quite fun, the things you can do.
Yeah.
The other thing that works really well is having them do a Jeopardy-style quiz, which means you give them the answer, and they have to tell you the question.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Because, again, it focuses on the specifics of what's being asked, and it's often easier to come up with a question.
Yeah.
Than if, and it does translate. If they can give you the question, they'll be able to translate it back to give the answer.
That's really
good. That's another fun way to do things. I'm going to throw one other plug in there for that middle school and even early high school group, and that's YouTube. YouTube can be a terrible time waster or a very interesting time waster, but YouTube is also a tremendous resource when it comes to definitions, scientific terms, novels. If there's a topic your middle schooler or early high schooler is studying, chances are somebody's done some YouTube videos on it, including some absolutely brilliant song parodies. You know, we have geometry song parodies. I'm so fond now of YouTube that actually in our new tutor group website at thetutorgroup.com, we actually have a YouTube link that lists a whole bunch of videos that go from everything chemistry to writing an LSAT exam to get into law school to spelling words and provinces in their capital. So they start as early as grade one.
That's
and
great.
They go all the way up through university. Huh. And there's some amazing material out there. It's not where you start your study, but it's a great reinforcer.
Yes.
Especially if you put on the closed captioning, which is a little CC at the bottom. Your kids usually know how to do that, so they can see the words as well as hearing the lyrics. And it's a great way to take a break. It's a lot of fun to practice, and it helps reinforce what they're learning.
Those are great ideas. I didn't know about that, so that's great. So as we move on, so kids or young, teenagers have highlighted or put the sticky notes or organized their material. Maybe make quizzes for one another. So a lot of good information there about preparing. And then the actual studying, again, in terms of environment, for example, I know you and I talked about environment in a previous podcast on developing good work habits. And here again, we talked about, whether we should sit at a desk or do work from our beds and what works for one student and not for another. But again, you talked about having a clean kind of work environment where you could leave things out and things didn't get moved off the table, like a kitchen table, for example. Would you say that same principle, is that one of the things that you would recommend for studying?
Yes, with two exceptions. As children get older, because of different learning styles, they sometimes require either more space or more privacy for study. So I see particularly teenagers who need to, and when I say spread out, I mean really spread out. And they're actually very effective at this when they study. Now that's fine at the dining room table if you've just got one teenager. But if you're trying to use that dining room table for three or four of them, that might not be as good, and that may be a reason why, whether it's a desk, but a desk at a table, and a desk at a table in their bed, in their room, might be a better place for them to do that. I have a number of students who read out loud, or sort of talk to themselves. It's called sub-vocalization.
Yeah.
They're speaking quietly, but they're reciting, or chant, or jump, or move. It doesn't always work in the traditional homework place for them to do that. It's great to tell a student to go to the library, but those kind of students won't do well in the library. So again, it's going to depend on their study style, but the idea is to have them know what they need and then figure out the best place for them to do that.
And how do they know what they need? Is that also trial and error? You study in a different place each time to see what works best?
I think it's a combination of things. Sometimes when you're, if you're playing a game with your child and you realize that instead of writing it down, they do better by saying it to you or, you know, giving it to you and putting a little joke in there. You can help them identify that when they're, oh, I noticed that, you know, when you spell the word out loud and then you write it, you have an easier time than when you write it down. Is that what you find too? You know, in other words, you can ask them. So when they're young, you start helping them
identify
some of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that it gives them room to do things differently. I also know, for instance, a number of students who have taken homework and studying in particular way with them when they go on holidays. And they've actually found that sitting in an airplane seat with, you know, earbuds on, whether they're listening to music or they're just blocking off noise, is actually really helpful for them.
Yeah, they have no other distraction.
That's the first time they've ever sat still to do work.
Yeah.
So again, I think sometimes identifying what works, just because we can't always do it the same way all the time, is really helpful for them to then apply later on.
And you know, talking of that, talking about like blocking noise or listening to music, I mean, I would imagine that every student would study differently in regards to those distractions. So whether it be music on or people talking around them, or, you know, nowadays, more specifically, phone right beside them as they're texting or on social media or flipping back and forth between multiple tabs, you know, not related to schoolwork on their computer screen. I mean, I'm wondering how that all plays a role in effective studying versus not.
Studying is a high attention, high arousal activity. So it's really difficult to do too much else while you're studying. Kids don't like to hear that.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah.
So, you know, they might listen to music as a relatively passive activity unless you're singing along or, you know, scrolling through playlists. And, you know, I mean, if you're going to have a feed that works for you and you don't have to fiddle with it, you don't have to actively do anything, that might work well. We do not allow our students to keep their cell phones on and by their sides. Literally, we just ban them from study sessions. We sometimes will allow them in homework sessions, depending on the student or an organization sessions, but not when it comes to studying. It just breaks the concentration too much. And we'll say to somebody, you know, are your friends important? Oh yeah, my friends are really, really important. Oh, of course they are. That's why you can't be communicating them when you're studying, because they're important.
Yes.
And they deserve your attention. If you can't give them your attention, keep it off. And they'll get kids to the point where they'll sometimes just post a message on their social media, or they'll put a funny Instagram, the equivalent of, you know, do not disturb, you know, I'm being forced to study type of thing. Some of them will be creative about that, and some of them will be, you know, blaming about that, but we actually get them to let their friends know that they're off limits because they're worried about missing something, you know, the whole fear of missing out.
That's right, FOMO.
And so we want to, you know, it's true, be respectful to your friends, tell them you're off limits. Then we'll say, well, how long do you think you're going to study for? Maybe an hour and a half. Okay, you know, it's not like you're disappearing for a week.
Right.
So why don't we just let them know for that period, and then you'll check back with them, you know, after you're done. So, yeah, we tend to keep the phones out of the way and the multiple tabs, if possible, not rotating, because we get distracted. And what I try to say to the students that we're working with is, if I'm distracted and you're paying me to be here, I'm not going to be a very good tutor.
Yeah, you know,
over time, we hope that they make the connection that if they're distracted and they're paying to have someone help them, or they're just paying, you know, by giving their own time, they're not doing a very good job of studying. But studying is high arousal. It's high stakes. It's high concentration. It's different than homework or daily routine stuff. And it does require as much attention as possible.
And that must be tough, especially for university or college students that are away from home, who may not have come to terms with that when they're living at home.
Right. And that can be a very hard thing to do. There are universities, colleges have done quite a good job in encouraging study groups.
Yes.
And study groups these days are often assigned. They're not things that people create out of their own friends. And
right.
So that can be helpful. Also, the teaching assistants assigned to most of the classes will provide extra support as needed. But when it comes down to it, most dorm rooms, and most first-year students, if they're away from home, are in a dorm.
Yes.
Dorms are small, noisy, hot, sometimes smelly places.
Yeah.
If there's ever a time to use, whether it's the library or the cafe or the student quad, to get out of your room and study is what we try to tell kids. Because most dorm rooms are just not very conducive to studying.
Yeah, you have people knocking at your door to say hello.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also it's very claustrophobic. It can be somewhat depressing because you figure everybody else is out having such a good time. So we work on the different places in campus where, you know, you might study well, and we try to help students. If once they pick the university or a college, you know, we'll do a virtual tour with them, and we'll look at the different services, and we'll come up with, you know, 3 indoor and 3 outdoor places that are cool that you could go study. So we kind of identify that ahead of time.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they have to take themselves there at this age, you know, and they have to do the studying themselves. But if it's planned ahead of time, they actually often appreciate that, getting that heads up. I have one student who always studies at the gym, which I think is really funny because her gym has this nice little kind of cooling off area with massage chairs and a, you know, you can get a nice cappuccino nearby. Yeah. It's a very luxurious little gym in the school, and she likes to study there.
Hmm.
And that works for her. It wouldn't be typical, but, you know, again, there's different ways to do it. But, yeah, unfortunately, dorm areas are not generally very conducive to studying, even in the common areas. The common areas and dorm rooms are usually used for video gaming or sometimes for, you know, floor meetings, that sort of thing. So get out of your room and study is usually what we try to tell them then.
I'm also thinking, you know, of university college-bound students or high school students in regards to sleeping patterns, like sleep hygiene. I know that more and more kids are going to bed like really late at night or really early in the morning the next day. And you know, saying, I'm fine, you know, I can survive on 5 hours of sleep. But do you know anything about the effectiveness or the issues around sleep, you know, and studying?
I'm very familiar with the research around sleep and studying, and also very familiar with student sleeping habits, which really have drastically changed in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
As adults, our sleeping habits have slowly changed. Now, if you look at the research, people are getting less sleep and are not having as many kind of battery recharge days or holidays where they really don't do much than they used to. But that's a slower, more gradual change. Not a good thing, but it happens in kids' students. It's been quite dramatic, partially because most students still, or many students, take their phones and their computers into their room with them at night. And even when your phone is off or your computer is on sleep mode, the little blue light, and people have heard about this, I think, by now, that the blue light that emits is actually incredibly disruptive
to
sleep cycle. And it's very hard to block that off. You also have people who are texting and receiving messages at all hours of night. And, you know, students say, well, I'm not going to answer. If my friend texts me at 3 in the morning, I'm not going to answer. I said, well, good. Then why is your phone in your room?
But then what do you do with kids who are at university or college and in a dormitory and everything is just in the one room?
Yes, that makes it really, really tough. So a couple of things have happened that help. One is there are a couple of devices out there which are lock boxes, and they actually were invented to stop people from overeating junk food, that sort of thing. But you can actually lock up. They come in different sizes. You can self-lock your devices in a cube. Okay, you set the timer, and you actually can't break into this thing. Students have tried without damaging your devices, and you set it on an alarm for as long or as little as you want it. They're usually clear plastic, but you can drape something over it, like a jacket or whatever. The idea is that you can see that they're there, and you know they're there, but you can't access them.
Interesting.
Okay, and there's a huge market in that, and it was a Dragon's Den invention, a Canadian, who came up with this initially, and they've taken off all over the world. So that's one way to do things. The other way is to set up a charging station. And I like this one because it actually reminds kids to keep stuff charged.
Yeah.
I know I'm constantly running out. I love my iPad.
Yeah.
I have a really close relationship with my iPad, and it's always running down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm pretty organized. So kids are often without battery or can't charge their stuff. At home, get a charging station, but here's the tricky part. Everybody at the end of the evening, puts their devices on the charging station, usually somewhere near the front door.
Yeah.
Kind of like where we used to hang our keys at night, you know, and remember people had little key hooks and all the family would hang their keys up?
I still do.
Nobody needs to go to bed with a device.
Right.
And so parking your devices on the charging station, and if you start them really early,
right,
the kids don't see that as directed at them or control issues or discipline issues, and it's really good for you, too.
Yes,
very good. Put your device away.
Right.
You also end up not taking them into the bathroom as often. They don't get dropped down the toilet. You know, those are the kinds of things that kids need to learn.
Exactly.
It's when they're away and they're at school and they break or lose their devices, it's very expensive to keep replacing them. So get them away from or out of the room. And if they have to be in the room, literally throw something over them, because the blue light is very, very damaging. But I would argue that most people don't need a device in the room unless you're in a dorm room, in which case you have to come up with one of the other strategies we mentioned.
So we're talking about the lack of sleep. So teens are getting less sleep, more interrupted sleep.
They're poorer quality sleep.
Yes.
They sometimes are actually getting more hours. In fact, there's several studies that say teens are actually sleeping, and young adults are sleeping more hours than they used to, but they're more tired.
But they're also taking naps during the day, I find.
Yes, but they're more tired.
Right.
And they're more tired because they're not getting quality, refreshing sleep.
Right.
There is also lifestyle, you know, and so if you're going to party, if you're going to indulge, you know, in substances, if you're going to learn, hopefully, good lessons about when to or if to do that, that's going to mess up your sleep, too.
Right.
Usually that's a fairly short-term lesson to learn. What we're really concerned about is regular, you know, habits over time, that if you can't get restful sleep, you're going to have a hard time writing those exams. And parents should remember that university and college exams are much longer than high school exams, generally twice as long.
Right.
So an exam that would have been an hour or an hour and a half at your child's high school is now anywhere from 2 to 3 hours.
Right.
We're going to talk about accommodations a little later, but if your child also has extended time on a three-hour exam, time and a half, that becomes 4.5 hours.
Right. So if they haven't had a good night's sleep or they've had a
cumulative... None of us can stay awake and alert in one spot.
Right.
And
if it's accumulated, as you said, if it's over a long period of time, then it makes them even less likely to be able to...
It's actually called a sleep debt a sleep deficit.
Right.
And if you remember that what we know, Sarah, about debt, when we pay our debts back, there's interest, right? We never just pay back what we owe.
Exactly.
And so when you have a sleep debt, it's not just that you get to catch up on your sleep. It's that you actually have to pay back with interest.
Right.
Your body needs more sleep over time than you actually missed. And that's really hard for people to understand unless you think of it in that, you know, you're paying back with interest kind of context. We also know more recently that things like diabetes, high blood pressure, any metabolic-related illness can be aggravated or accentuated by poor quality sleep or by consistent lack of sleep.
Right. So in the studies that you've read, have you noticed that test-taking and being successful on taking tests and exams is affected by sleep then?
Well, certainly academic achievement affected. I don't know that they could accurately measure individual
tests specifically
because experimental method would probably prohibit that, but definitely the idea of getting sleep, that we often say to students, well, you're going to have an exam tomorrow, get a good night's sleep.
Right.
That's not the time to start the good night's sleep.
Right.
Some kids have a lot of trouble falling asleep for an exam, now, even the little ones, when they're writing a test or as they get older, you know, an exam. What you want to do is have them rested beforehand. And I tell students, don't go to bed too early the night of a test. Because if you go to bed too early, meaning, you know, more than 15 minutes or so or half an hour before your regular cut, you're going to lie in bed stressing out and going, oh dear, I have a test tomorrow.
Yes.
And you're just going to ruminate about these things, and you're actually going to have more trouble falling asleep.
Absolutely.
So same thing with getting up. You know, if you can, try to get up maybe a little early, get 15 minutes early. But if you make yourself get up too early, you're going to be overtired and cranky. And, you know, even if you went to bed a little bit earlier, it's not going to pay off.
Right.
So it's more about being rested.
Right. So we've come to the test-taking day, the test or the exam.
Day, yes.
What strategies do you recommend keeping in mind for the day of, during test-taking, and even afterward?
The larger the test or exam in terms of the amount of content, the less studying you want to do the day of the test. Okay, basically, if you don't know it walking in, it doesn't matter. If you don't know it that morning, it doesn't matter. So some of my really anxious students, I don't even let them look at their notes going into a test because they usually psych themselves out and get more anxious. What we'll usually say is choose a time. Again, this is part of a work back schedule we've talked about before where how you plan your study time. Choose a time the night before. Let's say it's dinner time. Let's say it's 8 o'clock, whatever. That's your study limit. After that, you're not going to study. But here's the other piece. You don't do anything really high arousal. So, yes, you might relax, have a nice dinner, go for a run, have a shower, do whatever it is you like to do, but it's not the time to go see a horror film.
Right.
It's not the time to have a major discussion with your boyfriend or girlfriend.
Right, exactly.
Try to avoid...
Or argument.
Yeah. Try to avoid those high emotional activities right before a test or exam. But less last-minute studying is really important. If you're a believer in a lucky charm, or if you like to have, your certain lucky sweatshirt or whatever, great, just prepare it ahead of time. Because if you're one of those kids who's a bit superstitious about how you like things on a test or exam, chances are when you wake up and your lucky sweatshirt is dirty or you can't find your lucky charm, that's going to freak you out.
Yes, of course, because you're more stressed.
All kinds of kids are superstitious. I mean, you'd be surprised how many of them, and they know, I think, they really know that it's not, the penny or the bracelet or the whatever that's helped them. But it's just like in sports, they don't shave their beards when they're going to play and in the Stanley Cup where they wear their stinky t-shirt that they wore because they scored the last goal.
Right. It's just superstition.
It's a psychological advantage. Why not?
Exactly. It doesn't harm anyone.
I really wanted to emphasize to parents, if your child is writing what you consider to be an important test or an exam and you are still involved in their everyday lives, you need to back off or tone down your own anxiety. I'll often ask kids, which of your parents is a little more chill about you went before you take a test, and they'll tell me sometimes it's mom, sometimes it's dad. Then could you deal with that parent in the morning, if possible? If there are two parents and you have the luxury of doing that, use the other parent or, siblings, same thing, or friends. If you have a friend who's really high stress, don't walk to school with her that day before the test or exam. Try to not up the anxiety level by the people around the child.
Right.
That can really make a big difference.
Okay. And then afterward?
After the test, again, depending on the child's reaction, I rarely ask a child, how do you think you did?
Yeah.
Because most kids have no idea.
Yeah.
And whatever they say, it's going to cause them to feel worse.
Yeah.
Because they think they did really well. What I'll ask them to do is to describe the test back to me. So if you were a fly on the wall, if you were a TV reporter, and you were narrating this, tell me, so when we walked in, I sat here. I took out my lucky pencil, the teacher handed out the test, but I face up or face up, face down. And so they describe literally step by step what happened, but we don't use things like the how did you do.
Yeah.
Or did that go well or not? Because usually I can tell from the child's description of what happened in the facts of the test, how things went.
Right, exactly.
The other thing we'll do sometimes is do what's called an autopsy after the test. So you can do autopsies for all kinds of problems. But if a test has gone badly, if we know it's gone badly, or a child feels it's gone badly, we ask them to write up, just like an autopsy on a body, the reason. Make an argument for why it's gone badly. You're a lawyer, you're arguing in court, convince the judge as to why it's gone badly, and then we check to see how valid their autopsy is after the fact. Because some kids just have to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
They're catastrophizers anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we can then say to them, okay, so the worst possible scenario is that you got, you said you think, you might have gotten as bad as, for some kids that might be zero, some kids that might be 75% as bad, whatever. That was your, So what will happen? What's the worst possible thing that could happen if that's the case? And then we work backward from there. But being able to do an autopsy after the test does help some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the idea that the teacher should actually mark the test or exam and give them back to the student. I have real trouble with teachers who take a very long time
yes.
to mark or who forget to return things. And I don't like the fact that many children never see their final exams, because knowing your own grade is really one very small piece.
Right.
I want to know where that came from. You know, where they were. It's not that we want to mark the teacher or check the teacher. We want to help the student to improve.
Right. Right. Especially with what you do.
And without that information, it's very difficult for the student to make improvements.
Right.
But here, as a parent, especially for younger children, here's where you do need to self-advocate. You don't want to irritate the teacher, but there's nothing the matter with saying, you know, it really helps Cindy or Cynthia to know that she gets the, you know, her test back, because she can then see that she, you know, what she's done wrong or where she's learned from her mistakes. What can we do so that she gets them back more quickly than she does now?
And the other thing that you could tell from that is whether it's around the content that she gets wrong or whether it's around the test taking anxiety. You know, does she rush through something or does she miss
part? Their content inside and out, but if they actually have significant test taking anxiety, that's really important, because studying more won't help test taking anxiety.
Right.
That can actually accelerate it.
So talking about that, I know there are some students who receive special accommodations. Like if they do have test taking anxiety, then they may be, you know, they may be able to write it separately or something like that. Or if they have other learning disabilities, they may be able to use spell check or calculator on their tests or exams. So in your experience, what are the most common accommodations and who are they made for if needed?
So I'm going to use the term accommodations with capital A, even though we're speaking. So accommodations are things that students receive in order to level the playing field. They're not meant as cheats. They're not meant as advantages. And sometimes they're given out for the wrong reasons. But when a student has an identified special need, they've had a professional say, this child has a learning disability or this child has test anxiety, not just they're nervous, because being nervous is normative.
Right.
Being having test anxiety so that you don't produce anything is not normative.
Right.
So you certainly spend the time and a half, or sometimes just we're not timing you. When you're done, you're done, is the most common of accommodations. Using technology, a calculator, spell check, or a computer, hopefully one that is not hooked up to the internet, basically as a typewriter, okay, is another accommodation. But the ones that people forget about that I think are really useful are ones like what we call prompting. So that if a student is writing in a small or a separate area, which many students, whether they have test anxiety or learning disabilities, they can write their test in a resource room or in the guidance office or in another space. You don't just put them in the room and shut the door or have somebody sitting just to make sure that they're actually doing the work. They are allowed to be prompted or guided, not around the exam answers, but in terms of the task. So a student who starts staring off into space, the prompter can say, I notice you've been looking into space for a while. I'd like to help you to redirect your attention back to the test. That's different than saying, what's the answer? Or how can I help you with the answer?
Exactly.
It's breaking the cycle if the child is spinning. Same thing with redirecting. If a student hands in the paper and it's clear that either they've been very impulsive, children, for instance, with ADD, attention deficit can be very impulsive, and they just want to get it done, get it in, and get done with it. But they've left off the last two pages. You're allowed to say to that child, hang on a second, let's have a look at this. Look, these two pages are blank. You actually have another 40 minutes. It's your choice. You can sit here for 40 minutes, or you can go back and work on that. But in other words, we don't give them the you can leave now. So prompting and redirecting can be very, very helpful, but you need a smaller or private or a quiet space to do that, because those two fit together. The other one is scheduling, and this is much more for our post-secondary students, sometimes for grade 12. But you can have an accommodation that says if you're getting half or double time, no more than one exam, not test now, but exam, in a 24-hour period.
Okay.
Because realistically, and we've talked about sleep, we've talked about the need to, you know, to stay on top of your material. If you're writing an exam that should have lasted till 7 o'clock at night, but yours is taking till 9 o'clock at night, because university and college exams are often in the evening, because of your extended time, and your next exam is 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to study your cram right before an exam. It's really difficult for you to transition. Learning disability or not, it's difficult for you to transition between those two. But certainly if you have EDD or anxiety or an LD, it's really not helpful for you to have more than one evaluation, major evaluation, in a 24-hour period.
And these accommodations, as far as I understand, are typically only when a child has been identified through some kind of an assessment, correct?
Assessment or a professional letter. Psychologists, social workers, counselors, and sometimes family doctors.
Even if there's been
a letter saying this is the diagnosis, they don't have to go into a lot of detail if it's just for a school. If it's for a standardized test or exam, which is a different story, something that is externally marked,
right,
there may be very special regulations around how to get accommodations for those.
Right.
The really important thing, though, if your child is entitled to accommodations, is to get them to use them early on.
Mm-hmm.
Many children either avoid using them because they don't want to be different.
Right.
Or parents say, well, he or she doesn't always need them now, so I don't want to give her an excuse. I don't want to make it easy for her. The universities and colleges believe, and I think correctly, that children who need accommodations should be using them and practicing all the way through school, not just getting to university or college and saying, oh, yes, I need accommodations now.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find that often programs can be very resistant to putting accommodations in to a university or college program if a child hasn't used them in elementary school or high school.
They'll be more suspicious, perhaps, too.
Well, yes, because there are also people who claim accommodations because when they don't need them all the time. And there are, unfortunately, professionals who produce reports that are not accurate, that
right,
not true.
Right.
But child can get accommodations. So, you know, it's something that schools struggle with. But the idea is that part of being a responsible learner is to use what you need. So my accommodation when I drive is my eyeglasses. Okay? I don't see well without my glasses. That is an accommodation. But really, I could if I had to. I wouldn't drive on the highway, but if I had to drive to the corner store without my glasses, I'd be okay. Chances are I wouldn't hit anybody or bang up the car. But it's really not a responsible way to drive.
Exactly.
And so I need to be in the habit of wearing those glasses every time I drive, whether it's far or short, or whether it's a hard drive or an easy drive. And when it's really sunny out, I need to wear the tinted ones.
Mm-hmm.
As the glasses on their own don't do it. So, you know, I can't put sunglasses on top. So, you know, I'm using a simple analogy.
Well, no, it's a great analogy because, as you said at the very beginning, it puts you on a level playing ground with other people who don't need glasses.
That's
so
right.
It's not like, so it's not an,
already does.
It's, so it's not an entitlement per se in that you are entitled or better, you know, that you're getting something that somebody else isn't entitled to. But it's, as you said, it's just putting you on an equal playing ground so that everybody is starting out at the same base.
It's so important, sir, that kids hear that language as well from
mm-hmm.
their teachers,
mm-hmm.
from their parents, from their peers. Well, can't control the peers, but hopefully from the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when we talk about a formula sheet is what's given to many high school students in math, and in science, where you may have a memory issue for instance, you know, the formula for how to calculate circumference of a sphere.
Right.
Or versus circumference of the surface area of a cone or the surface area of a cube. But you need to know how to use that formula and when to apply it.
Right.
So the formula sheet tells you these are the formulas. You then have to use them. Those are commonly referred to as cheat sheets.
Yeah.
The schools call them cheat sheets.
But they shouldn't be called that.
No, absolutely not. Even memory aids sounds a bit much. They're formula sheets. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's all they are. They give people formulas. If
mm-hmm.
you don't know what to do with the formula, or you don't know which one to use or when to use.
How to apply them.
You're no good whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So the language we use around accommodation is very important, and it starts early, and it starts at home as well as at school, so that the child doesn't feel that they only should have this if or when they're doing badly.
Right, right.
Just like I can't say, well, after I crash the car, I think I'll start wearing my glasses.
Exactly. They wouldn't appreciate that. Is there anything that I've missed out on? Anything? I think you've been amazing, as always, in terms of giving very comprehensive, very clearly articulated information that I think everybody will benefit from. Is there anything that I've missed out on asking that you have a burning desire to share?
I'm just going to do a quick reference to standardized tests, because we haven't really talked about those. Standardized tests or standardized exams are ones that are set externally. They might be set by your province or your state. They might be set by a group of schools who want a child to try out or test for a school, or by a professional school. And they are ones that you don't study for in the same way as you would for regular tests or exams. If your child has the opportunity, as a little one, to take a standardized test that is just a checkup, that doesn't have high stakes, it's just one that, you know, sometimes they're called bubble tests, because there's a lot of multiple choice sheets involved. And in Ontario, we call those EQAO tests in grade 3 and 6. But, you know, they have them in different provinces and different states. I'd encourage families to allow their child to take the standardized test, even if theoretically you may have philosophical differences, if your child may not be as ready as some of the others, because it's just a chance to practice. It's like, you know, in the batting cage, or when you swing the heavy bat before you try the regular bat.
Right.
Children do need to demystify standardized tests, and they need to get used to multiple choice and bubbles, and the only way to do that is to practice. And if you have a low-stakes test that doesn't really matter or count for a lot, it's actually better to let them try it than to keep them home or withdraw them, because that's giving them a different message.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be harder for them to get past when they are ones they can't avoid.
Right. Good information, and something very important to keep in mind. Thank you, as always, for all this very valuable information, Janice.
Oh, my pleasure, Sarah.
And for more information on Janice or to listen to other podcasts, please check out the podcast section at helpmesara.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at helpmesara or on Facebook at Sarah Dimmerman, Help Me Sarah. Until next time.